As I said before, we're in continuing in 1 Kings, and we're going to have our reading from 1 Kings chapter 10. If you've got a church Bible with you, that's on page 348. There's 348 in the church Bibles. The reading and sermon are going to happen sort of in two parts. I'm going to read some parts of 1 Kings chapter 10. Tony's going to come up, and then midway through, I'll come back again and read some parts from 1 Kings chapter 11, but I'll direct you as we go. So listen out for the verse changes, because we're not reading the whole chapter, but we are starting 1 Kings chapter 10 at verse 1. When the queen of Sheba heard about the fame of Solomon and his relation to the name of the Lord, she came to test him with hard questions. Arriving at Jerusalem with a very great caravan, with camels carrying spices, large quantities of gold and precious stones, she came to Solomon and talked with him about all that she had on her mind. Solomon answered all her questions. Nothing was too hard for the king to explain to her. When the queen of Sheba saw all the wisdom of Solomon and the palace he had built, the food on his table, the seating of his officials, the attending servants in their robes, his cupbearers, and the burnt offerings he made at the temple of the Lord, she was overwhelmed. She said to the king, "The report I heard in my own country about your achievements and your wisdom is true, but I did not believe these things until I came and saw with my own eyes. Indeed, not even half was told me. In wisdom and wealth, you have far exceeded the report I heard. How happy your men must be. How happy your officials who continually stand before you and hear your wisdom. Praise be to the Lord your God, who has delighted in you and placed you on the throne of Israel. Because of the Lord's eternal love for Israel, he has made you king to maintain justice and righteousness." Jumping ahead a bit to verse 13. King Solomon gave the queen of Sheba all she desired and asked for, besides what he had given her out of his royal bounty. Then she left and returned with her retinue to her home. The weight of the gold that Solomon received yearly was 666 talents, not including the revenues from merchants and traders from all the Arabian kings and the governors of the land. King Solomon made 200 large shields of hammered gold. 600 beckers of gold went into each shield. He also made 300 small shields of hammered gold, with 3 miners of gold in each shield. The king put them in the palace of the forest of Lebanon. And then jumping ahead again to verse 23. King Solomon was greater in riches and wisdom than all the other kings of the earth. The whole world sought audience with Solomon to hear the wisdom of God, the wisdom God had put in his heart. Year after year, everyone who came brought a gift, articles of silver and gold, robes, weapons and spices, and horses and mules. Solomon accumulated chariots and horses. He had 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horses, which he kept in the chariot cities and also with him in Jerusalem. The king made silver as common in Jerusalem as stones, and cedar as plentiful as sycamore fig trees in the foothills. Solomon's horses were imported from Egypt and from Kew. The royal merchants purchased them from Kew. They imported a chariot from Egypt for 600 shekels of silver and a horse for 150. They also exported them to all the kings of the Hittites and of the Arameans.
Well, good morning, everybody. So, our subject this morning, as you've already heard, is Solomon's downfall. So let's just pray before we start. Father, we thank you for your word and for the example and for the teaching that comes from it. And as we look at this sad account of how what began so well ended up going rather badly, we pray that you'll help us to learn from it, to heed it, and to respond in our own lives appropriately. So we commit this time into your hands now and pray that you'll speak to us through your word. In Jesus' name, amen. As usual, there are handouts at the entrance, if you want one on the way out. There are some minor changes, as is inevitable, because I have to do the handouts on sort of Friday and the final polishing of the sermon later, but basically it's very similar. What we have here is a turning point in the history of Israel. I've listened to Tim's overview of 1 and 2 Kings, which was while we were away, and he brings out the way in which things thrive under David and Solomon, and then after that the kingdom divides into two, and it all goes rather downhill. So this is the big turning point. And also, it's an occasion which brings out some of the really big themes of life. And Tim has already mentioned, I think, in his prayer, money, sex, power, and also the whole question of worship. These very big themes come out in these chapters. So we start with Solomon in his prime. And last week, Tom did chapters, I think it's 5 to 8, and I'm doing 10 to 11, which leaves 9 in the middle. And Tom made a few mentions of chapter 9, and I'm just going to put it in its context by quickly mentioning chapter 9. Because straight after the dedication of the temple, God appears for the second time to Solomon and gives him, first of all, confirms his promises to Solomon and to his descendants. That's the good news. I will establish your royal throne over Israel forever, as I promised David your father when I said, you shall never fail to have a man on the throne of Israel. But immediately afterwards, he goes on to give a warning, warning Solomon against turning to other gods. I'll just read on verses 6 and 7. If you or your sons turn away from me and do not observe the commands and decrees I have given you and go off to serve other gods and worship them, then I will cut off Israel from the land I have given them, and I will reject this temple that I have consecrated for my name. That warning was given straight after the dedication of the temple, so a bit of a dampener on the events. You know, here's this fantastic new temple built, dedicated, prayer of dedication and so on, and then immediately, yes, a promise, but also a warning. So we do have an indication already that things aren't necessarily going to go well. Then one other point from this chapter, which again Tom alluded to last week, are forced labor. There's this glorious temple, and even more glorious palace. And how is it brought about? By forced labor, by the enslavement of non-Israelites, and Israelites were conscripted for forced labor for a period of time. And so there is a dark side to this, the exploitation of power. And that's something which can be seen in the text. And chapter 12, straight after our passage, when Solomon dies, the people say to his son, your father put a heavy yoke on us, but now lighten the harsh labor. So there is this sense of a very heavy burden being placed upon the people. Well, surely it's all for God's glory, it's for the building of the temple. Yes, but also for the building of Solomon's palace, which was rather bigger than the temple. And there's a considerable element of wealth and ostentation. I was struck in the first half when we were singing that chorus towards the end about honor and glory to Jesus, and then John got up and we sang the last bit again without accompaniment. And I thought, what a contrast. This is giving all the honor to glory, all the honor and glory to Jesus and so on. By contrast, what we see with Solomon is, yeah, the temple is to God's glory, but the palace is very much to Solomon's glory, and there is an emphasis on Solomon's wealth and ostentation. So there are signs that things aren't going so well. Then the passage, our proper passage, from chapter 10, we have the visit of the Queen of Sheba. And the Queen of Sheba comes from the south. I'll be showing you on a map in just a minute where she came from. And she was bowled over by Solomon's wisdom and wealth. I'll just read again verses 4 and 5. When the Queen of Sheba saw all the wisdom of Solomon and the palace he'd built, The food on his table, the seating of his officials, the attending servants in their robes, his cupbearers, burnt offerings, etc. She was bowled over, or actually overwhelmed in this translation, but that's the same thing. She was just blown away by it all. And what we have here is basically a diplomatic trading visit. So we have a neighbouring ruler coming and the exchange of gifts and so on, and diplomacy. It then ends with verse 13. King Solomon gave the Queen of Sheba all she desired and asked for, besides what he'd given her out of his royal bounty. Now, I remember as a student going to lectures on the Old Testament, and I remember hearing from the lecturer that passage read, it had put in a rather suggestive manner, and there was sort of sniggering in the audience, and I thought, you know, some people, you know, they think, they, you know, just got a dirty mind or whatever. But actually, I discover that what is referred to here, in Jewish tradition, later Jewish tradition, there is the idea that the Queen of Sheba returned home carrying Solomon's son. So this isn't just some sort of modern innuendo. This is going back to an ancient tradition. I'm not saying it's necessarily true, but it isn't a recent idea. Now, as a number of you know, I've been in Ethiopia for 3 weeks. I just got back recently, primarily work, but a fair bit of travel as well. And while I was there, I had this email from Roxana that always makes my heartbeat faster. It said, you're due to do something for the upcoming week. And I thought, oh no, I'm getting back Saturday morning. Surely I'm not preaching on Sunday. But it wasn't. It was this Sunday. So that was good news. And then when I read the passage, I could not believe my eyes. Solomon and the Queen of Sheba. While we're in Ethiopia, we've been hearing nothing about this except Solomon and the Queen of Sheba. And I thought, how often do we have a sermon on Solomon and the Queen of Sheba? Every 10 years, maybe? And it's just after I come back from Ethiopia, and I happen to be the one preaching. So that is a most bizarre coincidence. So Ethiopia. First of all, I have a little quiz for you. Who can tell me, what was the first country in the world to adopt Christianity as its official religion? Anybody know? Sorry? No. Well, it was Armenia. What was the second country? That was Ethiopia, in fact. Ethiopia was the second country in the world in the 4th century to adopt the Christian faith as its official religion. Okay, so here's a little map. Ethiopia is obviously on the left-hand side, the African bit. The city at the bottom is Addis Ababa, which of course is the modern capital. Ethiopia goes some way south of there, but that blue line is indicating the way to Aksum in the north. And Aksum is the ancient capital of Ethiopia. So when Ethiopia adopted the Christian faith, Aksum was the capital where it happened. I'm not sure whether Addis was even part of Ethiopia then, let alone further down. And Ethiopian influence extended onto what is now Yemen, in the bottom of Saudi Arabia, or the Arabian Peninsula, I should say, and that is where the Queen of Sheba came from. Now, last week, I'm afraid Tom slightly misled you. Tom said that when the temple was destroyed, the Ark of the Covenant was destroyed with the tablets and so on. Now, as anyone in Ethiopia will tell you, that is not true. Before the temple was destroyed, the Ark of the Covenant and the two tablets with the Ten Commandments were brought to Ethiopia. And that building there is where they are today. And there is only one person who oversees it, who I understand sort of more or less lives permanently in the building, and then presumably a monk, and when he dies, somebody else takes over. So that, in that building, that is where the Ark of the Covenant and the Ten Commandments are. At least that's what is widely believed in the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. I'm sure no one else believes it, but but that's believed there. But also the connection between Solomon and the Queen of Sheba and the emperors. The emperors of Ethiopia all claimed, down to Haile Selassie, to be descended from Solomon. Here's a fairly typical picture with different events from the life of from this episode. You see at the top left-hand side, there's the Queen of Sheba heading up to see Solomon. Bottom right, there she is on her boat heading back. And if you look on the bottom row, about the middle, you see a little episode with the Queen of Sheba and Solomon in bed together. And that's typical of these sort of pictorial cartoon accounts of what happened. That's always a feature there because of this belief that the emperors were descended from Solomon. There's another picture here of Solomon on the left meeting the Queen of Sheba on the right. And just a little close-up, notice the shield of the soldier. There's the Star of David. Well, that's understandable. And inside it, a cross. Well, somehow I don't think that Solomon had a cross on his shoulder, on his shields. But that's sort of how things are in Ethiopia. There's sort of this mingling together of fact and legend and times getting a little bit blurred and so on. Well, then we have what is called the Queen of Sheba's Pool, although evidence is it's rather more recent than that. Not terribly nice for swimming, but anyway, that's... the Queen of Sheba's Palace, supposedly, with a tourist there being shown the way by a guide. And finally, the pillar that supposedly was marking the Queen of Sheba's burial place and has fallen down. Well, what has all this got to do with 1 Kings chapter 10? To be honest, not very much. But Tim did say to me he wanted to see my holiday pictures. But also, I think it is of interest, at least in passing, to see how these things have been taken, even if it's not something you would generally hear in this part of the world. But it's taken very seriously indeed in Ethiopia amongst the Ethiopian Orthodox. Anyway, returning to 1 Kings 10, and Solomon's wealth, Solomon's phenomenal wealth. Let's just read again a few verses. Verse 14 of chapter 10. The weight of the gold that Solomon received yearly was 666 talents, and the note at the bottom says that's about 23 metric tons, quite a large quantity of gold. Not including the revenues from merchant traders, all the Arabian kings and governors of the land. And then it shows how Solomon, out of this, made shields of hammered gold, etc., etc. So this phenomenal wealth and extravagant display. Verse 18. The king made a great throne inlaid with ivory. Ivory is quite beautiful. What do you do with it? Well, you cover it up with gold so no one can see it. And overlaid it with fine gold. So this is extravagant display of this huge wealth. Now, some people have thought this is obviously a wild exaggeration. It's not really credible. And around, this is actually 35 years ago, that's right, a man called Alan Millard came and gave a lecture. We have an annual Lang lecture at LST, and he gave a lecture called Solomon in All His Glory. And he examined this, and I remember it very well. It was a very memorable talk, and I was able to reread it yesterday just to refresh my mind. And he shows how credible, how feasible it all is. The quantities of gold that are referred to are all paralleled elsewhere. You get surrounding nations like Egypt and so on with similar quantities of gold. The ostentatious way in which it's displayed, again, is in line with what people did at the time. And then the most interesting thing of all is he shows how in Egypt, a few years later, there was a massive influx of gold. Where did that come from? Well, the answer is in chapter 14, verse 25, where it says that in the fifth year of King Rehoboam, that's just 5 years after Solomon died. In the fifth year of King Rehoboam, the king of Egypt attacked Jerusalem and carried off the treasures of the temple of the Lord and the treasures of the royal palace. He took everything, including all the gold shields Solomon had made. So there's Solomon with all this wealth and lavish gold and so on. How long did they have it for? Just 5 years after his death. And then the Egyptians came and took it all away. And there's evidence that for the in Egypt at this time, suddenly a massive influx of gold, which confirms what is said here. The irony is that Shishak, the pharaoh who came and took it all away, was actually Solomon's father-in-law, as we'll see in a moment when we look at his wives. So family, well, you know, sometimes problems with the in-laws can get rather drastic. They come and take all your gold away. Well, there was huge wealth, and a couple of verses, which I think Tim read in his beginning of the month, if I remember rightly. All King Solomon's goblets were gold. All the household articles were pure gold. Nothing was made of silver, because silver was considered of little value in Solomon's days. Obviously, a little bit of exaggeration there. Probably of little value if you were the king. If you were a peasant, it probably would be seen slightly differently, but it just shows, nonetheless, you know, how much gold there was. The king made, verse 27, the king made silver as common in Jerusalem as stones and cedar as plentiful as sycamore trees. So huge, huge wealth for a time, but as we see, it didn't last very long. And then chariots and horses in verses 26 to 29. Let's find my place again. Again, it talks about the huge number, 1,400 chariots, 12,000 horses, and so on. So, huge wealth at that time under Solomon. But all this was contrary to what we read in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 17, verses 16 and 17, which I'll read to you. Talking about the time when they would have a king. The king must not acquire great numbers of horses for himself, or make the people return to Egypt to get more of them, more horses. For the Lord has told him, you are not to go back that way again. He must not take many wives, which we'll see happening in just a moment, or his heart will be led astray. He must not accumulate large amounts of silver and gold. So Solomon had acquired huge wealth, but this was contrary to what we see in Deuteronomy, where the warning is given of what will happen and the danger if they go that route. Right, well, we now turn to chapter 11, and Tim will come and just read to us again. Thank you.
So chapter 11, if you've lost the page number, it's 350 in the Church Bibles. Again, two sections, but we'll start from verse 1. King Solomon, however, loved many foreign women besides Pharaoh's daughter, Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites. They were from nations about which the Lord had told the Israelites, you must not intermarry with them, because they will surely turn your hearts after their gods. Nevertheless, Solomon held fast to them in love. He had 700 wives of royal birth and 300 concubines, and his wives led him astray. As Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father had been. He followed Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. So Solomon did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not follow the Lord completely, as David his father had done. On a hill east of Jerusalem, Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the detestable god of Moab, and for Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. He did the same for all his foreign wives, who burned incense and offered sacrifices to their gods. The Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice. Although he had forbidden Solomon to follow other gods, Solomon did not keep the Lord's command. So the Lord said to Solomon, since this is your attitude, and you have not kept my covenant and my decrees, which I commanded you, I will most certainly tear the kingdom away from you and give it to one of your subordinates. Nevertheless, for the sake of David your father, I will not do it during your lifetime. I will tear it out of the hand of your son. Yet I will not tear the whole kingdom from him, but will give him one tribe for the sake of David, my servant, and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen." Jumping ahead to verse 26. "Also Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, rebelled against the king. He was one of Solomon's officials, an Ephraimite from Zeredah, and his mother was a widow named Zeruah. Here is the account of how he rebelled against the king. Solomon had built the supporting terraces and had filled in the gap in the wall of the city of David, his father. Now Jeroboam was a man of standing, and when Solomon saw how well the young man did his work, he put him in charge of the whole labor force of the house of Joseph. About that time, Jeroboam was going out of Jerusalem, and Ahijah, the prophet of Silo, met him on the way, wearing a new cloak. The two of them were alone out in the country, and Ahijah took hold of the new cloak he was wearing and tore it into 12 pieces. Then he said to Jeroboam, 'Take 10 pieces for yourself, for this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. See, I am going to tear the kingdom out of Solomon's hand and give you 10 tribes. But for the sake of my servant David and the city of Jerusalem, which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, he will have one tribe. I will do this because they have forsaken me and worshipped Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, Chemosh, the god of the Moabites, and Molech, the god of the Ammonites, and have not walked in my ways, nor done what is right in my eyes, nor kept my statutes and laws, as David, Solomon's father, did. But I'll not take the whole kingdom out of Solomon's hand. I have made him ruler all the days of his life for the sake of David, my servant, whom I chose and who observed my commands and statutes. I will take the kingdom from his son's hands and give you 10 tribes. I'll give one tribe to his son, so that David, my servant, may always have a lamp before me in Jerusalem, the city where I chose to put my name. However, as for you, I will take you, and you will rule over all that your heart desires. You will be king over Israel. If you do whatever I command you and walk in my ways and do what is right in my eyes, by keeping my statutes and commands, as David, my servant, did, I will be with you. I will build you a dynasty as enduring as the one I built for David and will give Israel to you. I will humble David's descendants because of this, but not forever.' Solomon tried to kill Jeroboam, but Jeroboam fled to Egypt, to Shishak the king, and stayed there until Solomon's death."
Thank you, Tim. Right, well, we move on now to Solomon's wives and his worship. And as Tim has just read, Solomon had foreign wives, wives from other kingdoms, from Moab, Egypt, and so on, Pharaoh's daughter. And also, he had this in huge numbers. We're not just talking about one or two, 700 wives and 300 concubines. So I think we're talking about rather more than what one might say was diplomatic necessity. You could argue that as a king, there was a need to make some alliances with some local nations and so on in that way. But 700 and 300, I think, goes way beyond that. Now, some people may feel that this is every man's, well, not every man, but some men's fantasy. However, we have a comment on this in Ecclesiastes, in particular, chapter 2. Ecclesiastes in chapter 2 is presenting life, as it were, from Solomon's perspective. And it talks there about his immense wealth, the number of wives that he had, and his wisdom. And the judgment at the end was, "When I surveyed all my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun." So Solomon had this great wealth, massive number of wives and concubines, but it doesn't mean that he was satisfied by it. And as had been warned, as warned in Deuteronomy, as warned in chapter 9, the result of this was that he was led astray into the worship of pagan gods. So he actually, well, first of all, it was a case of his wives having their shrines for worshipping this god or that, and then Solomon himself being led astray by that. And the contrast is drawn with David. He did not follow the Lord completely, as David, his father, had done. Well, David's history, of course, was a somewhat checkered one. David, you remember, was guilty of adultery and murder. But what David was not guilty of was going astray after foreign gods. That is the significant point of difference. And so it is in that sense that David followed the Lord completely, in the sense that he didn't get led astray and start worshipping the local gods of the area, even though David's life showed many features where he went astray, like with Uriah, as I say, adultery and murder. So we have then God's judgment on Solomon. And Solomon's sin. In 1 Kings, it mentions particularly the worship of other gods, and that's where the focus lies in Kings, in the books of Kings. So, as I say, David is talked about following the Lord wholeheartedly because he wasn't guilty of this particular sin. Now, by contrast, if you read the prophets are sending a warning and judgment on the people of Israel, the both kingdoms, and there it's primarily for issues of social justice, of exploitation, and so on. So we have two different aspects, both true, of course, but the emphasis in Kings is on pure worship, not being led astray to other gods, and in the prophets, the emphasis lies more on justice and mercy and features like that. And both of them have their place, have an important place, a role to play. And of course, Solomon was guilty on both counts, in the sense that here, as is brought out here, the worship of other gods, but also issues of exploitation, the forced labor and so on, although that is sort of mentioned here, but not given the same emphasis, but it's certainly there in the account in 1 Kings. And so God's judgment is pronounced on Solomon, the loss of the 10 northern tribes. And this isn't going to happen in Solomon's lifetime, but will happen after his death. And of course, the rest of the books of 1 Kings and 2 Kings are about the two kingdoms, the northern kingdom, the southern kingdom, and that division is not healed in the context of these two books. And so the opposition begins during Solomon's lifetime, and there's Hadad, who is was opposed to Solomon and exiled into Egypt, and Rezon, also, who was against Solomon and exiled into Syria. And I'm just mentioning them very briefly because the much more significant one is Jeroboam. And that's the passage that Tim read. Because unlike the other two, Jeroboam wasn't just somebody who thought, wouldn't it be nice to get rid of Solomon? But Jeroboam was appointed to that by God. And we read how the prophet met him and told him that he would have the 10 tribes, the 10 northern tribes. Well, obviously, Jeroboam was not going to be Solomon's favorite after that. I presume it was done privately, but these things get out. And so Jeroboam fled to Egypt until after Solomon died. And then right at the end, in verse 43, it says how he was buried, and Rehoboam, his son, succeeded him as king. And, of course, that's the story for the next time, which is not next week, but the week after, I think, where we'll see it actually happen, and what was the warning that was given to Solomon, the judgment that was pronounced, actually takes place. But what about us today? What about us today? If we look at 1 Kings, the passages that we've been through this month, in chapters 3 and 4, and I wasn't here and I haven't heard this one, but Chris Reveille, on Solomon's wisdom. And in chapters 3 and 4, there is a lot about Solomon's wisdom. Chapters 10 and 11, There is a bit about Solomon's wisdom, but much, much more about Solomon's wealth. So we see this shift from Solomon's wisdom at the beginning to this preoccupation with wealth. Yes, a beautiful temple for God, and yes, an even more beautiful palace, a bigger palace for Solomon. And so what has this to do with us? 1 Corinthians 6. We're not talking about Solomon, but talking about events of the Old Testament. Paul says, these things were written, these things occurred as examples to keep us, us from setting our hearts on evil things as they did. And that could apply word for word to what we've been reading. These things occurred as an example to keep us from setting our hearts on the wrong things that Solomon did. And then 1 Corinthians 10, verses 12 to 13. If you think you are standing firm, be careful you don't fall. And in the light of Solomon, that's something we should all take to heart. If we think we're standing firm, well, Solomon, such wisdom. None of us can get remotely close to that. And yet, look what happened to Solomon. And we might give another example from the New Testament. Judas, one of the 12 apostles, chosen by Jesus. None of us remotely gets close to that. And yet, what happened to Judas? So, if you think you're standing firm, be careful that you don't fall. Well, so in other words, no complacency, but nor despair. That might lead us feeling, you know, what hope is there? So, verse 13, no temptation has seized you, except what is common to man. God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. So, no room for complacency. No room for complacency as we look at what happened to Solomon. But nor should we despair and think, you know, then there's no hope for any of us, because that's simply not true. So we don't have to go the way that Solomon did. Jesus warned against this in the parable of the sower. You remember there were the four different types of soil. And the seed, the one who received the seed that fell among the thorns is the one who hears the word, but the worries of this life and the deceitfulness of wealth choke it, making it unfruitful. Well, Solomon was very fruitful initially with his great wisdom and so on, but in the end, the deceitfulness of wealth and other things, as we've read, choked it, and in the end he turned away to the worship of other gods. So the Bible warns repeatedly against the dangers of wealth, and a couple of passages again from Deuteronomy chapter 8, a warning to the people as they entered the promised land. Be careful you don't forget the Lord your God. Otherwise, when your herds and flocks grow large, your silver and gold increase, and all you have is multiplied, then your heart will become proud, and you'll forget the Lord your God. And there's a sense in which we see that with that's what happens with Solomon. And then in Proverbs 30, verses 7 to 9, two things I ask of you, O Lord. One of them is, give me neither poverty nor riches, but give me only my daily bread. Otherwise I may have too much and disown you and say, who is the Lord? Or I may become poor and steal and so dishonor the name of my God. So what we have there is a prayer that I should neither become too wealthy nor too poor, but that God will keep me satisfied. Well, maybe you think, that's about where I am. You know, I'm not over wealthy. I'm not a Donald Trump, and I'm not poor. I'm sort of in the middle. Well, during the last week or so, I read that for the first time, the top 1% in the world own as much as the other 99% put together. So it's all those wicked bankers and people like that. Except that, if you live in this area, and if you own your house, in other words, if you've paid off your mortgage, then almost certainly, you are one of the top 1%. So we have to see these things in a global perspective. So the dangers of wealth, and all of us here, in terms of other parts of the world and in terms of how people lived in the past, are incredibly wealthy. And we need to heed the warning of that. In the book of Revelation, chapter 3, there's a warning given to the church at Laodicea. You say, I'm rich, I've acquired wealth, and I don't need a thing. But you don't realize that you are wretched, pitiful, poor, blind, and naked. Well, as I mentioned already, I've just been in Ethiopia. Ethiopia is an incredibly poor country. I was checking the figures yesterday, and for last year, Ethiopia was 166th out of 186 countries in terms of GDP per capita. The GDP per person in Ethiopia for last year was $700. That's £500. That's £10 a week. Now, in the UK, it's 63 times that. Now, I know those figures are misleading because they're dependent. They don't take into account exchange rates that fluctuate. They don't take into account the cost of living and so on. But nonetheless, they do reflect the contrast between considerable poverty and considerable wealth. So there we are, very wealthy in this country. However, in Ethiopia, the Kale Haywick Church, which Desta and Joe belong to, that church has been doubling in numbers every 10 years. So here we are, great wealth, but where are we spiritually? And by contrast, there they are in great poverty, but seeing a considerable spiritual blessing. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying there's any automatic, you know, anybody who's wealthy is spiritually poor and vice versa, but it just shows that, you know, we can focus too much on our material wealth. It talks about, again, Solomon being led astray by his wives and his foreign wives. And here I think also what we've had in the West since the 1960s has been, as we all know, a sexual revolution in which in areas of sexuality we've become increasingly permissive. Now, in many other areas of life, it's gone the other way. If you think we're regulated in, you know, what we can eat, the food we can have, the having seatbelts in cars and all that sort of thing, and I think there's nothing wrong with that. But there's a contrast between other areas where generally we become more regulated and the area of sexuality where we become increasingly permissive. Russell Moore, who's, I think, a very interesting American writer, I heard him being interviewed, and he said, thinking of America, but I think it applies to the West in general, evangelicals, he said, are slow train sexual revolutionaries. What do you mean by that? Slow train sexual revolutionaries. What he's saying is basically the rest of the world is rapidly going that way. We're following, just, you know, there's a lag, 10 years, 20 years, but we're going in the same direction at a slower speed. And to be perfectly honest, I don't have much confidence in the church in the West's ability to resist this strong tide. However, so I have a gloomy perspective on where we're heading in the immediate future in this country, but let's put that in perspective. For the church worldwide, I'm incredibly optimistic when you look at China and the massive growth of the church in China, a country like Ethiopia, as I say. There's a lot to be encouraged about worldwide, but we have a tremendous Christian heritage in Europe, but that's no guarantee for the future, as we saw with Solomon. God is not bound to the past, and if people go astray, they can pay the consequences. Then lastly, warning to individuals. Again, just very briefly, as people go older, often, not always, but often they acquire more money, more power. And there again, the warning of Solomon is to be heeded. We mustn't let wealth, as it increases, power, as that might increase, mustn't let that go to our heads and lead us astray. Right, let's close with prayer.